Well, thank you ever so much, Charlotte, and I promise to do the wrap-up rather quickly. I just wanted to share a few thoughts that came to me over the last 2 days or so. Obviously, there are very many contributions. First was to thank everyone here for participating, whether you were formerly a speaker or whether you intervened with questions and comments or pulled me or others aside and shared your thoughts and experiences. I've learned a great deal from you, and I'm very grateful for that. And I think we've had a very good dialogue amongst ourselves, learning with each other. So thank you for that. Another thought that I had six thoughts. One thought that I had was that I think many of us, myself included, tend to work within our little silos. And so one thing that I think is very beneficial coming from this conference is learning about the other perspectives on the same problem, and that perhaps now we can have some skill sets and some tools and some contacts to try to reach out to when we're asked, how do you do this, or what's the best way to approach that? And I thought that was very valuable. The second thought was, again, the need for data. If you're not counted, you don't count. And whether we can go back and forth about specific massaging or use of data or misuse of data, the fact is, if you're not counted, you don't count. So we need to create more information to help us in our advocacy roles. The third thought is that we need to learn the different languages and the different use of translating information and advocacy to different stakeholders. So, for example, it might be useful at some point to sit down with an employer who does not want to accommodate someone with schizophrenia who needs 10 minutes a day to focus out the voices and say, well, gosh, wait a minute. Don't you have a large number of people who smoke and who take themselves out of the building and across the street and into the smoking ghetto and whatever for 10, 15 minutes every day? So why is this different? And Susan referred to this as thinking about adjustments. Or perhaps it might be useful to sit with a state person, a government person, and say, you've got to procure contracts on trash bags and pens and clipboards. Why not the disability sector as a target for filling some of those contracts? And Dan and Stanislaw made good comments about that as well. A fourth one was the commitment from the top. We heard over and over again anecdotal stories and insight into how things get done. And over again, we hear about the commitment from the top, because when the boss cares, everybody cares. And that's true whether it's the World Bank or Walmart or a government agency. When the person at the top cares, everyone cares. It's on the agenda. And that's a really hard one to figure out. We know that there are disability champions. We know that there is the hidden army of persons who have non-visible disabilities or have family members or friends or other connections with persons with disabilities. And finding them, sometimes they're wonderful. They just magically appear. Honestly, it's not into magical realism, but sometimes they really do magically appear. And sometimes they have to be elicited and cultivated. The fifth thought was that we need as well to remember about the good things that companies do. As much as we may be angry or frustrated with the lack of employment in the formal and the open labor market for people with disabilities, we need also to recognize and to laud and to applaud and to publicize those companies that actually go out of their way to hire people with disabilities, to create more of a positive and conducive dialogue rather than a negative one. In our work, for example, we are wrapping up case studies of companies in China which voluntarily employ people with disabilities. Do they hire large numbers of people with disabilities? No. Is it easy to get that data in China? Absolutely not. But if in a place like China, which if you take the American Industrial Revolution, the Canadian and UK Industrial Revolution, the Western European Industrial Revolution, put them all together and inject it on steroids, in an environment like that, when you have not only multinationals but local Chinese companies who are going out of their way to hire people with disabilities, it can be done everywhere. And so we need to remain positive and to continue these outreaches. And finally, a story, because it's always nice to end with stories, and this brings us back to Jody's gracious and invigorating opening of the day, which is about time frames. When I first went to law school many ages ago, it was 1985, and I went up to the august halls of Harvard. This was before the ADA. This was when nobody cared about the Rehabilitation Act as far as universities were concerned. They still don't. And I met with the dean of students who was in charge of any sort of questions about your admission process to Harvard. And she explained to me very clearly, we have one dorm with one ramp on it and one room that we set aside for the odd person with a disability. I guess I'm an odd person with a disability. For the odd person with a disability who comes up here, and you can have it for 3 years, but we're not going to do any retrofitting or adjustments to the room. We're not going to do anything to the restroom. There's no kitchen on your floor, and it's 1985, so you can't have a microwave because those things are dangerous, and little green monsters will come down, etc. And there's no laundry facility for you. There are no elevators to the underground tunnels that connect all parts of the law school, so when it's snowing and raining, your classmates will go underground in the lovely linoleum corridors, relatively comfortable, and you will go barefoot, backwards, uphill, right, through the snow and ice, and all that sort of thing. And eventually, when I became the first person with a disability in 100 years to be on the Harvard Law Review, I climbed up and had to crawl up the stairs for 2 years. But welcome to Harvard Law School. And 20 years later, because we're talking about time frames, I was back then teaching and running the center, and I was back for about a year or so, and taught for the first time there a disability law class, and I told my students about what it was like 20 years ago. And they looked at me like they had never heard something that outrageous and stupid in their lives. How on earth could this have been? How could a university, people who claim to teach about laws and about inclusion and who talk about diversity, have treated the one law student with a visible disability in such a manner? There were others with visible disabilities, but, and they think it was bizarre, and they think it was unacceptable, and they cannot in their minds imagine that that's what the situation is. So in 20 years, we went from my classmates sometimes caring more or less thinking it was normal to my students, the same kind of demographic group, thinking I was outrageous and unacceptable, and how on earth could that have been? And I think that's beautiful. So rights take time. We'll get there. We'll need to persevere. And I'm sure that we will get there with employment as well. But we'll get there.
There's no way to follow on either Charlotte or Michael summarizing. It was tremendous and moving, and I have nothing more to say on substance than has already been said, but I do hope you're going to stay with me nonetheless for a minute while I say thank yous, because we have some important thank yous to say before we all go. First, I'd ask just briefly for Jen Proudfoot, Talia Bronstein, and Sheena Malwani just to stand where you are. Thank you. These three have, as you all who have interacted with them know, have really been organizing this for months, and it wouldn't have been possible without them. I want to say a special thanks to Maria Barilli, who has been our accessibility consultant. She's co-director of AdaptTech Research Network. Please join me in thanking her. Everything we did right about accessibility, we owe to Maria and to Jen working together, and everything we did wrong, it's our responsibility for. There have been a whole series of staff and volunteers engaged, Gonzalo, Denise, Heather, Effie, Amanda, Danielle, Collie, Michelle, Laura, Jade, Ken, Melanie, Teresa, Michael, Josie, Ariel, Amna, Claire, Jane, Brittany, Mark. It gives you a sense of how much the commitment there's been, so I want to thank them all. Getting this done wouldn't have been possible without the translators in the back who were very grateful making this accessible in French as well as in English. It's going to be online for anybody who wants it. The fact that we can make it available online has to do with Richard and Stuart working so hard on the AV, so thank you. And we have had an amazing advisory board for the Disability Initiative, national and international, too large to name now, but we're deeply grateful to all of you who have served on it. And I want to say a special thanks to five. We have, across these 5 years on equity, if this is our fifth year, we have a policy advisory board. It's larger than this, but five of them are here with us. So Sean Tupper, Siobhan Hardy, Sharon Manson Singer, Michael McCullough, and Navanita Deary, thank you so much for all the time you've given. And most of all, thanks to all of you for being here with us. So thank you. Oh, and lest I mess up and I see Jen and I'm realizing I've forgotten one of the most important thing, we do take seriously your comments. In your folder is an evaluation form. Tell us what you liked. Tell us what you didn't. We learn every year, so thank you again for all being here.